Welcome to the Maintainable Software Podcast, where we explore the art of improving existing software with seasoned practitioners who have helped organizations overcome the problems often associated with technical debt and legacy code. I'm your host, Robbie Russell. On this episode, Julia Lopez, speaker and senior software engineer at Harvest, joins us. Julia shares her experience leading a complex overhaul of Harvest's billing system, managing legacy code bases, and navigating organizational change. Julia joins us from Barcelona, Spain. Julia Lopez, we're so glad to have you join us on Maintainable. Welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So as you reflect on your experience in the industry, what do you believe are a few common characteristics of, dare I say, well-maintained software?
So for me, it's having like a test suite you can rely on. I've been fortunate enough that I work always at companies with like a strong test suite. And it's always like a thing that gives you peace of mind when you are doing a big upgrade. It doesn't have to be perfect. It's sometimes not beautiful. Maybe we have too many tests. I'm proving that theory now that make everything slow, but it definitely helps a lot. And another thing for me, it's like having a team or like an engineering culture that allows for refactoring or like that belief that, you know, maybe we have to do something better because before we can build on top of that. So working in companies that like allow for that.
When you come into those environments, are there people already on the team that have a lot of experience with like refactoring, or have you been there when like the team didn't really have a lot of experience with that yet, but were able to build some of those skill sets themselves, or did they need to kind of reach for external guidance at some point to kind of help start steering that way to like, how do we stop just tacking on more things, but like maybe we need to revisit some part of our code base and reshape it a little bit so we can kind of take this forward?
I've been working in the same company for the last 8 years. And at the beginning, when I joined, everybody had a lot of experience on what they were doing. So everybody could see it clear when something was not working. So, and now I became that developer, right? Because this comes with experience as a, like, if you are new on software development, sometimes you don't see or you don't even feel you can touch something. So the way that I'm trying to mentor new developers with less experience is like, just, you know, you can change it. If it doesn't feel right, it might not be right. So like, just do a git blame. If that code has been there for more than 5 years, you can change it. You know, if it was done last day or like 1 week ago, go ask the person that did it and just consider why that doesn't feel right. But if it's old, you know, like at that time, the decisions were made. We don't know why those people are no longer here. There was a different style of coding. You can see that by the way the code looks, by even like the white spaces, like how the variables are named. So you can just go change all, but you need the experience. I don't even know how to educate people or how to teach unless I do it myself. So I'm trying to teach by lead by example and hope that one day they will be able to see it, as I had examples in the past of like, oh, look, that person was changing everything. You know, I can do it too. I also think not all the developers enjoy that. It can be very, very daunting to go into a big refactor. You can hit so many roadblocks, you know. It's always super nice when like maybe you are not changing how the product works and it's just like an internal refactor that makes the code nicer, the test suite more reliable, updates dependencies, but maybe you get to a point like, oh, I need to change the feature to make it better, or maybe this doesn't make sense anymore. This is not used anymore. And then you need to ask for approval or reach out to people, and that might delay things. So, and just stop the refactor. So I have so many branches, so many like, look, I can change this. And then, oh, dang, you know, it's there for a reason, or like, it's more complicated than I anticipated.
I think that there's two things you brought up there. There's the kind of the difference between, you know, like you're maybe assigned some feature enhancement or change to part of the software. That's your goal. And you're like, you dig into it and you're like, okay, well, it feels like we're going to be tacking this in. And if I just go implement this and ship it, I feel like we're making more of a mess maybe for ourselves in the long run. So maybe we'll do some refactoring here, but then there's always that time pressure or whatever pressure, the external pressure, like we still need to get this thing done, but maybe it's not going to be as quick of a refactor to model this part of the code base and still be able to deliver this thing in time. So I'll make a mental note that we'll come back to this later someday, maybe. And then, so you have these Git branches that go lingering for a while, and then maybe you get to revisit them or not, who knows. But versus the difference of having some time maybe available to your developers to just spend time working on the refactoring without necessarily having a specific feature like that's immediately needed to ship. So is your organization one that has capacity for that very often, or is that occasionally you get some capacity for that?
I would say we do have the capacity. We allocate some time. So now we are going to start with new projects. Some part of the team is like trying to research how that code is looking at the moment to see if we can make improvements before. Or we went through a big rewrite of the billing system, and that was not 1 year. It was like 3 years of rewriting, and it was a lot of moving pieces. So we had the time. It doesn't happen for all the features, you know. There's some ones that are more time pressing than the others. So we need to balance how much we can refactor, or some parts of the code are newer, so they might not need so much. Some parts of the code we've been telling for a while, you know, this needs like a bit of work before we can start adding on top of that. So we need to advocate for that. And usually, yes, we get it.
I wanted to touch on, you know, while we're prepping for this conversation, you'd mentioned overhauling the billing system at your organization. In the intro, I mentioned that you work at Harvest. And so for anyone that doesn't know what Harvest is, maybe just give me the quick little overview of what Harvest is.
Harvest is a time tracking tool where you can track the time, create reports on the time that you are tracking for, like client work or your own personal time, or companies that they want to track the time their employees are using for different projects. And then you can generate invoices and see a lot of details about that.
You know, one of the toughest parts of working with a team is staying organized, especially when you're all sharing the same inbox. That's where today's sponsor comes in. Jelly is the best way for a team to share an email inbox, whether it's for customer support, community organizing, or even managing banned emails. Jelly helps your team work together better without the hefty price tag of other tools. With Jelly, your team can collaborate on conversations with customers, users, and community members all in one place. No more stepping on toes or sending double replies. The "I got this" feature makes it clear who's taking the lead. And private inline comments and at mentions let the whole team contribute when necessary. You can even start conversations directly in Jelly, so everyone stays in the loop from the start. And here's the best part. Jelly's affordable plans are priced per team, not per seat. That means no extra cost as your team grows. Jelly gives you everything you need in a shared inbox. Without the clutter, you don't. Find out more at letsjelly.com and use the code maintainable for 20% off your first year. That's letsjelly.com, letsjelly.com. Try Jelly today, the shared inbox your team deserves. All right, let's get back to the show. Disclaimer, my company Planet Argon has been a Harvest customer for many, many, many years.
Nice.
Thank you for your service and helping us get paid for the work that we do with our clients. So you've been leading in that incredibly complex overhaul of Harvest's billing system, which sounds like a massive undertaking. So I want to dive into it a little bit. Can you walk us through some of the initial exploration? You mentioned like a 3-year project. Maybe talk a little bit about that planning phase for reworking the billing system. And what were some of the like maybe key findings that shaped how you approached the project?
Okay, well, we can start from the very, very beginning. When I joined the company 8 years ago, the engineering team was not separated in teams. It was more like, oh, we need to do this feature. These people are going to do it, right? And somehow organically, I ended up being the person that knew most about the billing because I had to fix some bugs, because I was working on billing features with some of my colleagues, and the people that knew from the past left the company. So I ended up being the person maintaining all that thing. And I noticed there was something off in the code and in the way that things were failing. It was getting more and more complicated. You know, I had to do a big upgrade of the libraries that we were using, and we were getting into dark areas, and it was always like, is this going to work? We don't know. And it's the billing. So very important piece of like technology is how we get paid, right? And the more I was digging into that and I was talking to other people at the company, experts or finance, I have this theory that if the code is not good enough, it might reflect also on the customer experience, or in this case, it's like more an operational experience, because a lot of people need to be able to see data about that, right? So the finance lead at that time already started a request of trying to improve the billing. And I was like, great, you know, we should do that. I want to do this. Amazing. And we have another app. If you don't know, Harvest has another app called Forecast, which is for planning resource allocation. And that app already had a newer billing powered by Stripe. And I was also taking care of that. So, right, I had like taking care of the Harvest billing, taking care of the Forecast billing. And I was like, great, I want to be in this project. So in around 2020, there was an initial exploration of like all the functionalities of the Harvest billing. We listed them all. And it was kind of a no-brainer that like at that time, maybe we want to use Stripe, because the other billing that we have already used Stripe. And we have experience with that. We know it works. People that are having problems in one billing system, they are not having problems in the other one because they are customers on both tools. So we did like a research on like, oh, this is the billing functionality that we have at Harvest. And this is how it would look if we implement that with Stripe, or how Stripe helps us to power that feature in a way that our current payment processor or subscription management tool would not allow, which created a lot of custom code. That's what makes things complicated. If you cannot rely on your subscription management tool for a feature, then you need to code it yourself. We are not finance experts. So why did we build financial reports? It's crazy. There were other priorities at the company at the time, and it was a project that it was not going to have customer impact, right? As long as maybe the customers that had problems, we could figure it out in a way. So it was creating like a burden on engineering and support. But customer-wise, like people, once they are subscribed, they don't go to their billing settings and see what's going on, right? So that was okay. But later, 2021, we did start that project. It started by making some improvements on the Forecast billing so we could like have the experience that we needed for the Harvest one. And it could not be, I mentioned that on the interview questions, we took the approach of a full rewrite, because if those custom functionalities, we would try to like, you know, kind of code them into Stripe features. It did not make sense because Stripe was already providing what we needed. So it was more about like, let's utilize as much as possible the subscription management tool, so our code is simpler. But if you try to, for example, let's say like we are trying to change the subscription management tool API calls and just whatever it's, if it's a customer in this tool, let's use the Stripe customer. That did not make sense, right? There was no simplification on that. So we took the approach of full rewrite. So just new records and models and services, better organized, better tested, because Stripe, I don't know, like they keep on providing for developers. The developer experience is phenomenal, and we could utilize as many things as possible. So now the way we can test in our local or the staging environments, it's astonishing, right? You can test all the flow of a subscription, but all of these things are coded within our system now. So it's great.
That's awesome. I'm curious about like a billing system like that. Do you also, when you're deeply integrated with something like a Stripe, are there not customers that aren't necessarily able to pay with a credit card or have other sort of forms of payment that you have to then work out those weird edge cases for some types of customers? And then is that where the complexity starts to get added in your stuff? Or are you able to do some of that more on your subscription management side of things?
That was one of the reasons for us to be able to use Stripe. So Harvest allows payments via credit card, which is the most common one, but like it allows also issuing invoices. So people can pay us by bank transfer or ACH or checks. Some people still use checks, apparently, more than you would expect. Or me as a European, like, what's that? So our current, I say current because we still have the old billing system in place. The migration is not easy. It is complicated. It's like a big customer base, and we don't want disruption So we decided to keep both systems and, you know, work our way from one to the other in a slow way. So right now we are in like the in both waters, you know, the new one, it's fully working. The old one, it's still working for a lot of people. So to your question, the subscription management tool that we are using right now does not allow the send invoice functionality within their subscription. So that's all custom implemented for us. So we use Harvest invoices to invoice our subscription customers, which makes the code a bit a spaghetti code. It's kind of not very nicely done. It's very old too, so I understand that. But now we strive. So we have subscriptions custom managed because it's this like invoice subscriptions, and the credit card subscriptions are managed by the subscription management tool. But now with the new system, all subscriptions can be managed by Stripe, which is a huge lift because when it comes to financial reports, all subscriptions are together. When it comes to the way we show the billing history, all subscriptions invoices, they come from Stripe. So that was one of the reasons that Stripe was a good choice for us because they allow that. And then you can select different payment methods for those invoices that are not paid via credit card.
With that sort of project and having, you know, multiple billing systems as part of that transition, I'm assuming, you know, you mentioned working with people like in the finance or operations, things like that. You know, what sort of lessons did you learn from coordinating such a large scale project with multiple stakeholders and teams?
Lessons that it requires a lot of people that I cannot do everything by myself. Obviously, because the way we were operating before, when I joined the company, it was more, we were given a job and we were figuring it out. You know, you go talk to the person that you think it might help you, the designer, the product expert. But now it required an organization that I had not seen before. It required for me to get out of my comfort zone because until that time, my work was always reflected on GitHub. So I could go to GitHub and then there was everything that I had done in the last 6 months, right? When you write your performance review.
Right.
But with that project, considering that I, at the time, I was the expert for whatever the reason, I was the person that knew the most about the billing code. And as I mentioned on the interview questions, I do believe that ultimately the knowledge is in the code. When there is no documentation, when that the person that whatever decided something, it's no longer at the company and you cannot go ask, you just can only rely on the code, right? So I was able to understand the code in a way that people that are not software developers cannot see it, right? And then I had to learn how to communicate better, how to be more transparent, how to share information in a way that it's not just on GitHub, it's like documents, meetings. It did change a lot. For me, it got better. I was very anxious at the beginning. I did not understand why it needed so much process and so much documentation when I knew what we needed to do, right? Because we were not creating any future. We were just translating what we had in another, in a new code, in a new system. Right. So it was like, we need to provide the same functionalities for the customers. This is everything that I know. But of course, you know, it affected finance. It affected the way the experts, they need to troubleshoot issues, you know, how we support our customers. It affects the customers to the help center because the flows are a bit different now. The forms are different. So I don't think at the beginning, everybody knew very well how to organize this. We were all very new in a new way of working. Then the way we were working, the project management that like we were using ShapeUp before and now we changed to Scrum, right? The like development, like, I don't know how you call that. That changed too. It got very messy until we were all like, okay, we know what we have to do. You know, we know how we communicate. We know how to bring awareness of this change. And I guess we are still navigating that. So that's what I learned, that it takes a lot of people.
Yeah, it can. And for that sort of thing, were you finding that, you know, as a developer and going through that sort of being part of that sort of transition, you're like, can I just work on the code? I know what we need to do. But then like, was it that there was more of a people needed to sign off on here's the technical direction that we're going to go. Here's the plan for it. Here's how we're going to migrate at some point. Then they need to have all that stuff sort of figured out before they would say, great, well, let's approve time to go ahead and do this. Did you feel like there was a sense of fear from any, not maybe anyone specifically, but just like a, we don't want this to blow up in our face at some point because we...
There was a lot of fear. I took it probably a bit personal too, as in like, I know how to do this. I just need the time, you know?
Quick question, actually.
Yeah.
I know you may or may not know this, but did you get a sense or do you know if there had been failed attempts to do this type of project in the past there? Like maybe projects that got started and then didn't get finished or fully realized. And so there was a nervousness. I might be projecting, but I have that every time my team's like, we need to rebuild this thing. And I'm like, oh, we tried that like 6 years ago and we didn't get that thing finished. So I'm just like, I don't want to spend the time and money on doing that if I don't feel like we have a good plan in place next time. I'm not saying that is the case there, but you may or may not have been around for that. But sometimes that sort of, those experience also impact people that are decision makers.
So I think for like companies, sometimes it's difficult to stop something that it has already started, right? Mm. So yes. They need to be very sure that this is the way we should go. And at the beginning of this project, the people that they were deciding this, some people might have wanted it, but not everybody. That's my takeaway. I really don't know what's like happened on the decision-making level. So some of those people that decided on that project left the company. And then we were like, wow, right? So what's going to happen? But I really believed in this project. Mm. Everybody that I was working with, the experts, the finance, we all believe on this, as in like, this is very important. But as I said before, it was important as in like an operational level, not a customer facing thing that we can offer and they will be happy about that, right? We had to navigate that. There were a lot of questions on when this is going to be over. When are we finishing this? What's the expectation? And then like estimations are hard. This was like an undertaking, like a huge one. It was not only like a huge system that we were building because we did not remove functionalities. I was like, oh, tell me something that I can remove. This tiny thing that we did for one user, why don't we tell them we cannot do that anymore, right? Or this kind of like discount that we are giving, why aren't we removing that, right? So, but that was like a bigger conversation and it needed like more effort. So we implemented all the same things in the new system, right? So we could support the people working with the system internally and our customers. So it was like a huge thing. And I was always pushing for it. Like, we need to do this. And I knew that there were probably conversations of like, oh, this is taking too long. It did take 2 years. It's not like they put 5 senior developers, always like sometimes adding more people into a team. It's not the solution, but like, yeah. It was me as a senior developer with 2 people that they were recently hired, you know, that you also need to like bring up, you need to do a good job and make sure this doesn't fail, because if the billing fails, it's like a high stakes service that we are running now. So yeah, there was a bit of fear on how that was going to turn out.
We'll be back with our interview with Julia in just a moment. Hi, it's me, Robbie. I wanted to take a quick moment to say thank you for making time to listen to the podcast. If you're finding these conversations valuable, please consider sharing a link amongst your peers. Maybe drop a link in Slack or Discord, on Twitter, Blue Sky, wherever you kids are hanging out these days. Or maybe write a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts to help spread the word. Also, do you know someone in our industry who you think I should interview on the podcast? Shoot me an email to Robbie with a Y at maintainable.fm and state your case. And now let's get back to our interview with Julia Lopez. That makes a lot of sense. And one of the points you made there that once a project starts, becomes very difficult to stop it. And it probably comes back to just sunken cost. I think probably is like, well, we're already on this path. We got to do it. People believe in it. But then you just keep throwing more. Sometimes those projects should get stopped. I'm not saying your project did, but there are projects that you go down the path and you're like, this is going to cost too much. Stop, pause, let's revisit this and figure out a different way to do this. Or maybe to say, no, we're not going to do this anymore. that's a hard thing for organizations to do. Kind of one of the things I want to kind of pivot a little bit to is like, talked about it a little bit early on, but like, you know, you mentioned like mentoring people that are joining and being a good role model of sorts of like, well, show them and then they'll kind of follow in a similar way when it comes to like, you mentioned like, well, if it's code that was written more than 5 years ago, go ahead and change it. And maybe those people aren't here anymore. So no one's going to be offended or not, you know, or just, but I'm also curious about like, what do you remember about joining projects that had been around for a while? What sort of situations did you kind of encounter when you're dealing with like legacy code bases yourself? And then how has that kind of evolved since then?
I don't think I remembered myself at the very beginning. I was probably following my mentor at the time, who is my friend who works at the company at Harvested. So that's, it's great to have him here. I was probably not so opinionated, right? So like, you just follow, like, I guess as a, like a less experienced developer, you just follow what you see. So I am all about consistency. So you go into a file, you try to keep it consistent to what we have. But also when I started software development, I always worked at companies that they were always taking very good care of the code. So I could rely on that. That was great. It was big companies. They had like an architecture team, you know, like a lot of people putting effort on like a proper code base. Whereas Harvest, it's a tiny company. It's not like a 1,000 people company, right? So you can see that through time, the code has evolved and the personalities of people show in the code or like the ways they wanted to do a thing, you know, like, I don't know, instead of creating, let's say a helper method, I'm going to set it in the controller instead of a helper. I don't know. There are some things that you easily can tell who did that because that's the way they wanted to operate. And at that time, on a tiny company, you don't set up a lot of rules. You don't think about the future, and maybe a less experienced person is going to join the team and they are going to be like, so what am I supposed to do if this file does one thing and the other one does another one? But the technology we use, Rails, sets some conventions that they are there for a reason. So for me, now it's very easy to like, oh, this doesn't follow the convention. I'm going to change it first and everything will be more clear. I'm not doing rocket science. I'm not making up new patterns. We are not so big that we need to like modularize and different domains or like, I've been going to conferences that they talk about like, wow, this seems complicated, but we just follow the patterns and the files that do not follow them, I just change them.
So, I mean, I don't know a lot about, you know, Harvest's internals as a time tracking app, invoicing tool, got billing involved and access credentials. I'm just trying to think like what I might assume about it. And the, you know, we work with organizations and we also work in the Ruby on Rails arena quite a bit. And there'll be a lot of interesting scenarios where projects kind of get a, maybe I'm not saying they're more complicated, but there's a lot of complexity built into their industry. Like maybe they work in healthcare within the United States, and that's a really complicated space, for example. And there's not a lot of public written material about like how best to think about these larger complex systems outside of like going and looking at those domain modeling patterns from different types of, that might be more common in maybe the Java world or other tech stacks, what have you. And so they're always trying to figure out like, well, where's this? We can follow the Rails conventions, but we're kind of operating over here in this other world. And we're like, we have this big complex Ruby app that uses Rails. Is it a Rails app or is this actually a Ruby application that uses Rails? And there's a lot of integration stuff happening behind the scenes. And they kind of start to like have to figure out which patterns they might follow for a while. And then that you can see it in the code base every 3 years, something else gets experimented with. And then they've got a 10-year application with like 3 to 4 different eras of patterns. And they're like, I don't know which one is the most beneficial. And then they bring in new people and they're not sure. And so they just keep modeling, replicating what they're already seeing. And so they call companies like us to be like, come in and help us with this. And you're like, well, what's working for you and what's not working for you? And it can be difficult to give them some really clear, actionable advice because we don't have a lot of like things to point to in the public sphere that could be like, this is what DHH says. No, not he's not writing about that sort of problem. So do you have scenarios like that where your teams have been able to be like, yeah, service workers work, objects work for us, or, you know, everything's moving over to these jobs? Or like, how does your team think about implementing patterns so that the new people coming in can have some direction? Or do you document like, hey, this area code is 5 years or older, then be a little skeptical of it maybe? Or if it's like, here's the things that we're really proud of and we feel like are really, really well tested, model this sort of coding approach or pattern?
Honestly, I don't think we have a process for that. We don't have, we are trying to get better at documentation. We rely a lot of code reviews, right? But like, because we are a small team, as soon as you have one approved, it's merged, right? Mm. We need to keep things moving, right? So like, there might be a case that like a pull request does something and somebody goes there, it's like, hey, but you know, we have this pattern now, we should use this one, but there is no documentation. So I think it would be a good idea. Maybe when you were talking, I was thinking about myself, oh yeah, I'm like, sometimes in code reviews, hey guys, I know this has been approved, but you know, it should be changed because we are using this. And of course, nobody knows because it's not documented. So the people that work on that are the ones that know, and you cannot be on top of everything, which is something that in the past, because we were less people, I could be on top of something, of everything. You could like follow on all the changes, but that's not a possibility anymore. So I guess we need to find a way to try to make sure that things don't fall through the cracks. So now, for example, we do have a team among senior engineers, so we can like kind of discuss more things, because before it was like, hey, I got an idea, I'm setting up the service pattern, right? That we have other patterns apart from the normal Rails conventions, of course, because we are not that tiny, or like, oh, I'm just in presenters now, or, you know, authorization policies. And then if somebody was approving, then it's done. It's on the code, right? But now we are trying to discuss more among senior engineers. Hey, I want to introduce TypeScript. So what do you think? Which is something that we did not do in the past. So it's an improvement, but still we are not very organized, honestly.
It's not atypical. It's a very, I think that's a very common sentiment that I hear from a lot of people that I talk about. I think it comes down to like, well, should we document this? It's also, it's kind of like an interesting thing where it's a communication thing, I think, as well. It's not just capturing like, well, if you looked at the document, because not everybody pays attention to the documentation all the time, or maybe they should, or I don't know, that's a different conversation. But it's also like changing your team's philosophy about how they're thinking about any of the things that you're regularly doing. It takes some like training or workshops or other ways that you're like, some companies have internal blogs, or even I find it funny that I'll talk to somebody that works in an organization and I'll reference something on maybe their engineering blog. And they're like, oh, that was the first time I learned that we did that sort of thing. Because someone on my team, like their engineering teams are so big, like that's how they learn from each other. It's not like their internal engineering team have all been secretly baking this really great pattern for things. And then like, wait, we should publish this. And everybody's like, yay. But it actually ends up being like a really small team of people that are trying something. And then they vocalize it on the blog. And then the rest of the team's like, oh, we can do that. Or that's new. I didn't know that we did that. And it's challenging for humans to be on the same page, I think, is probably the underlying theme here.
I guess it's challenging to, it's like not people is going to see historical blog posts to know all the decisions that have been made. No. So at the end of the day, what you have is the code and the pull request. I think there is a lot of knowledge in all of them. Now we gotten better at documenting in pull requests. So the changes we are doing, why this change is done this way. So there will always be a history there. It could be because I still hold on to the fact that we are not a lot of engineers, and there is a possibility that we cannot, maybe not be on top of all the changes, but you can skim through all the pull requests. I do that. So I skim through all of them, maybe not even open them, like just go on the notifications. I read the description. It's like, oh, this is interesting. I want to see how they did it. Or maybe knowing at least what's the latest thing that we've created. So in this case, from my domain, the billing system. So the billing system has the new patterns, and we are trying to utilize them as best as possible. So if you're building a new thing, go get as a reference. Or if I'm doing some front-end work, which I am not familiar with, and now we are using React, I'm always like, oh my God, every time that I go there, it's like, I don't know how to navigate. So I need something that I can use as a reference. So I go to my colleague, it's like, tell me what's the latest. So I'll use that because I can, I'm good at like filling up the gaps or like, oh, this works this way, it should be this way on another file. But I cannot set up like a front end by myself, a React environment or whatever. So we are relying a bit on that.
That's great. One of the things I want to, another thing I wanted to pivot to was thinking about developer autonomy in particular. And so like, and continuous improvement as well. But in particular around, how do you think about, you know, you mentioned having people come in and you were that maybe new person on the team at one point, but bringing people in, but like developers should be able to like untangle and understand older complex code without maybe a lot of constant support. So where does that line sit for you? Like, why do you think autonomy is so important for developers? Let's start with that. And then how do you think teams could better encourage that?
I think autonomy is important because it's when you struggle, when you actually learn, right? Mm-hmm. I know that you must find a balance between the time that you are going to spend on something, right? Those things, they need to be estimated. Now, another thing that I learned to go back to a previous question is my estimations are not valid. So we never go with my story points. We go with less experience. Even if I'm going to take the task, we don't use my estimations because, of course, I've been 8 years at the company in comparison with other people that have been too. So there's no way it can be the same. But for me, when I got deep in the rabbit hole by myself, it's when you go to places you wouldn't go otherwise. If someone is driving you through a thing, they will go directly to the things that like they consider are the most important ones, but you won't end up in like the darkest place of the code and see opportunities for improvement. That's how I find them. It's just like, I don't know how I end up in things that I don't know how that happened. I just go there like, oh, this is not used. I'm going to delete it. And then I get into rabbit holes with a million branches, as I said before. So I understand like maybe some hints at the beginning, if we want to speed up a bit, finding a solution for a problem or like an exploration. But if they would have the time, it would be great that they can come with like, oh, this is what I found, right? And apart from I found the problem, but I found all these other things that I also believe they are a problem. And I also believe autonomy is important because in this particular case, we are a remote company. So, and we also deal with different time zones. So it makes it more complicated for everybody. Like, oh, you know, I need to wait for somebody to be online, right? So it changes things. It's not like we are sitting together and we can have a chat. It brings a different way of working, working remotely.
Hey folks, it's Robbie here. I want to take a moment to tell you about my company, Planet Argon. Think of us as the pet groomer for your software projects, helping legacy applications go from a scruffy mess to a polished, show-ready star. Need a quick trim? We offer staff augmentation to tidy things up. Looking for a full grooming session? Our fractional development services are perfect for untangling technical debt and giving your software a fresh, shiny coat of features. We specialize in technologies like Ruby on Rails, React, and Laravel. So if you know of a company whose software is looking a little shaggy, slowed down by bugs, or needs some TLC, send them our way. We'll have it wagging its tail in no time. Visit us at planetargon.com. That's planetargon.com. All right, let's get back to the show. And remember, every software deserves a good grooming. How do you, as like a team, balance that with, I mean, do you have many junior or developers on your team right now? Or is it, you have mentioned you kind of have a small organization, but are there scenarios where it's like you want to promote autonomy, but you also don't want people to spend too much time unnecessarily spinning their wheels and just feeling stuck and like finding that balance of like, when do they reach out for like, hey, I could use some help, point me in the right direction. Like, or how would you like to see people being, you know, encouraged to like raise their hand and be like, hey, I could use some help versus like, keep digging. There's that when you're a junior developer and you don't know, and you're in a remote, I don't know, totally side note, when you started there, were you remote then?
At Harvest, yeah, but okay. Not when I was a junior developer myself. So at Harvest, I was already had experience, and I had my friend in Barcelona too. So it was faster onboarding for me when it comes to, you know, getting to know things about the company. I could just talk to him. I've given to kind of advice to people at the very beginning. You might feel there is a specific situation that happened at Harvest. So between me and the next hire, there was a gap of 5 years.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So I was hired in 2016, and there were no more developers hired until 2020. 5 years, right? More or less. 4.5 years. So I understand that. And those people are not juniors, but they are less experienced than a senior developer. Like they are navigating between junior and mid-level, yeah. Right? So I, at the beginning, I thought they can just ask, you know, yeah. go ask it. We are all super nice. This company, we don't have strong, like super strong personalities, or we are not going to be mean to you. Like one of the good things about the company, you know, and one of the praises that we constantly give to all our teammates is like, great, so much, super helpful, super nice. Thank you for helping me with that, for answering my questions as many times as needed, right? So I would like, just go ask. But it was daunting to join a company where like all the developers were like so experienced already. Mm-hmm. We were all senior. Most of us had been there for at least 5 years. So they started already with a different way of working than the one that I started working. I was dropped into a bug fixing from the very beginning. That brought me visibility among all the platform. And the way we were organized from 2020 is like we were in teams, you know, like this is the part of the code that you are supposed to touch or like that you are working on right now, which also drove me a bit of like, the whole thing, it's my responsibility. Mm. What are you talking about, right? Because it had been the whole thing mine before. Yeah. So it proved that was probably not the best approach for onboarding people, like the ones that they had to do. My approach was, I believe it's the perfect one. Just drop them to fix all the bugs, like the craziest, the better, right? So it created that at the beginning, they did not have visibility of how the whole service works as a one thing. So it took them a bit longer to maybe feel confident about that, or like having them the chance to talk to all senior developers. So because I was there for 2 years before I started working with mid-level new engineers, right? So I'm always like, find that person that you don't mind asking the most stupid questions, because I have that person and you won't see me asking the most stupid questions on a public channel. So choose me, choose whoever you feel more, you know, connected to, or like, and just go ask them whatever. I won't spend time. If I feel like I'm like hitting a dead end, I will just go ask, you know, for help. So that would be my advice to people. And I wish also that you could see mid-level engineers taking the initiative, like, I'm going to do this, right? But the way we were set up to work might have not allowed that at the beginning of their tenure at Harvest. It's changed now. You know, we've been improving the system. It's proven that we need to have people to actually learn about Harvest as a whole. So it's getting better, but it was very daunting at the beginning.
I can imagine the bringing in for anyone that's like a new person joining a company and trying to figure out, one, the culture dynamics, and then also the technology itself and the working style, and be like, well, this seems to be, it's such an interesting story where people come in and they're like, well, this is a seemingly a stable code base. This is a real product. People use it every day. So everything here, I'm going to assume, is with the best of intentions and it's good quality code. But you're also being hired in to come help improve things, but you don't know what, it's like, well, I don't want to say something and make someone feel, I don't want to ask a stupid question about something or make a suggestion and get turned down and then they stop asking. And on the flip side, if you're hiring people into your team and they're suggesting ideas and you're like, well, we tried that like 2 years ago, it didn't quite work out, so maybe not do that approach. But you don't have all that historical context either. So there's an interesting thing of like, you don't want to discourage people from suggesting ideas or asking those kind of questions, but also don't want people wasting a lot of time asking things. So it's such a weird balance there, I think, too. But I think your point about like finding someone that you feel comfortable asking stupid questions. And if you are the person that would love people to ask you more stupid questions, you should probably put that, like, say that to them. Like, hey, if you ever have any stupid
questions. They know.
Yeah. you let them know. That's good. Do you do anything like show them that you're capable of asking them, air quoting, stupid questions as well?
Yeah, sure. What I mentioned before about leading by example, you know, you put yourself out there. You ask questions on pull requests. I also make mistakes, right? Mm. I'm not creating the best code, and my peers, they find the mistakes in my code. So I'm always like, thank you, you're right. Being a bit like showing like, this is okay. There's nothing wrong about it, right? So yeah, definitely we've become more of, you know, public, or, you know, if there was a mistake in the code that somebody made me notice and I fixed it, I make sure that in a public channel, I say, hey, I fixed this. It was thanks to this person that mentioned that. So yeah.
Before we kind of wrap up, I want to get some advice for you for those listening. So let's imagine that there's someone right now that's part of a team and they've been there for a few years at an organization, and they feel like they've brought up some concerns about, say, some technical debt or some legacy code issues that they've been having to work around for a while. And they feel like they've asked a few times, like, hey, can we improve this? Maybe improve the test suite, or we need to deal with some upgrades. But they've heard not right now, maybe a few times. And so they've stopped asking because they assume the stakeholders don't want to prioritize that for whatever reason. Do you have any advice on how they might revisit that today rather than just going to look for a new job?
That's interesting. I am not the best person for ask for advice on how to follow the rules. I would say ask for forgiveness, not for permission. Something that I've learned, and I mentioned that before, when it comes to estimations, I don't estimate my points anymore. And then I take the time that I consider that it will create a better code and also deliver. So I've gotten better at, like, you know, I know this needs a bit of work. So I'm going to take that into account also when we estimate things. So I believe software experts, the software developers, we are the experts of knowing what the code needs. And if you have the support of your peers, try to get the time to do it what you believe it's right. But I don't know if that's going to cause a problem, right?
If anyone out there decides to just start doing something, just say, Julia said I could do
that. Estimate higher.
All right. Well, with that, a couple of quick last questions for you. Is there a non-software book that you recommend to people that you kind of work with that's not a programming book?
So with my manager, we had a book club in the past. We read two books, Radical Candor. It was in order for me to learn how to communicate my, maybe at the time, frustrations or thoughts in a more professional way. But that was also like showing what I really think and try to put my opinion out there and have it heard. So that book was good. And then there was another one that it's The Making of a Manager by Julie Suo, which was good for me because it was at the very beginning of my experience having a manager. And I did not know what to expect. So if you're going through the same things that I had gone through, which is like a huge change in the company culture and the, like, having a manager and like the way we are working, and you don't know what to expect, it's a good way to know what you can ask from your managers. Mm. And it made me notice that I don't want to be one, because it's like usually one of these progressions in software development that software developers go into the manager career path, which is not for me. So, but it's very insightful, like, to know, just to know how it works over there.
I'll include links for both of those in the show notes for everybody. But yeah, it's an important thing to kind of like navigate. And I think a lot of people are kind of trying to figure that out, because it's like, I think it just seems like the natural progression. But then I can't remember, there was someone I interviewed and they were talking about technical leadership roles and like, well, there's only so many ways you can kind of like level up, you know, air quoting, leveling up, progress in a career. And there's more manager jobs than there are technical leadership roles in companies. And like, there was this, just the way they're thinking about it from a statistical point. And you're like, there's only so many. So if you're going to be like a technical lead, like really high up in a company that's still like a contributor, you need to be one of the best at that. But if you be a manager, there's usually more people managing more people. And so it was like an interesting way of like thinking about it, like, and like that takes a different set of skills as well. And like your coding skills don't necessarily translate to setting expectations for humans and holding them accountable and giving them good feedback. And it's a very different skill set for sure. I'll include links to the books in the show notes for everybody. And where can listeners best follow your thoughts and ruminations about software engineering online?
I am on Twitter. I refuse to call it by any other name. I tried to change, but like I have all my connections in there on twitter.com/YukiDeluxe. So everything code related, I share there.
Well, with that, it's been such a delight having you join us at Maintainable, Julia. Thank you so much for stopping by to talk shop with us.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
You've been listening to Maintainable, a Planet Argon production. Editing by Claudia Armbruster. Post-production by Autumn Morgan and Ella Svensson. Emotional support from the letter M. For Maintainable, for momentum, for making things better. If this episode resonated with you, share it with someone who needs to hear it. Keep showing up. See you next time. Maintainable.